My dad told me a story about a pastor who decided to dress up in a devil suit. You know this story? He leapt out from behind the pulpit at the beginning of church, and all of his parishioners ran away, except for one old lady on the front row. And he said, "Ah, why aren't you running away?" And she said, "I've been on your side for years. I'm glad you finally showed up." So I hope you're not like the people who stayed to hear the heretic. And hopefully I have not been heretical, because I care. What's the queen of the sciences? So let me begin with two presuppositions. Every discipline, including philosophy, should bow the knee to theology. Why? Because theology, if useful and true, is more fundamental than philosophy or biology. Secondly, a really good reason to be a young earth creationist is that it's more cheerful. And it's this second view that I will try to defend. If I wander around too much, does it just drive you batty back down? Do I have to stay on this platform, or can you just follow me around? There are few enough of you that I feel like being more informal. So let me say this. When I was in grad school for philosophy, and early on in my time as an apologist, I noticed something that is true about our culture, and I want to pause and see if you guys see the same thing, and gals, whether this is something. I see I've driven away almost all the women. My wife would know what I did. Oh, thank you. Those of you who are still here, my wife, Hope, would point out whatever five insensitive things I said that drove everyone away. Anyway, yes, there you are. Good to see you. My wife, Hope, the fairest flower in all of Christendom, sends her greetings, by the way. She would have loved to have been here, but we have three kids. She's still homeschooling. And for some reason, the state of California takes a dim view of homeschooling from 2,000 miles away. So she's not with me today. The assumption that really began to bother me is this assumption, and I've noticed it in Christians. The more unpleasant an idea is, the more we feel a sort of an epistemological obligation to believe it. Have you noticed this? Now let me just stop. Has anyone else noticed this? If an idea is yucky, adopting it makes us feel good about ourselves. So Bishop Spong, having destroyed Christianity and caused the church, along with some of his compatriots, to dwindle down to nothing, is happy about his irrelevance. Because he thinks what? Having embraced a difficult truth, I get major courage props for having embraced a difficult truth. Now look, there are two possibilities, there are many possibilities, for what's going on right now at home with my wife Hope. One is that she is faithfully loving me and being my friend. The other is that she really married me for my money. This is possible, however implausible, given that I'm a philosopher. And she's out living it up, being a bad person. Both of those things could be true. Which do I want to believe? The first. And it's actually, I would argue, okay to prefer the first to the second. Now, if you have to believe the second, as many people, to their chagrin, have to discover its truth, then you should believe it. But it should take more than 52% evidence to get you there. So let me take a very basic marital example. I have sometimes thought Hope didn't love me. And there was decent evidence, not that she was being untrue, but that her love for me had waned, that she no longer cared for me as she once did. Now, she said she loved me, but against this word, there was a fair amount of evidence. And if I had weighed the current evidence against what I knew, it could be the case. I just want you to hear this, that you get to the point where the majority of the evidence tipped which way? For her or against her, our relationship? Against. Notice I did not immediately abandon my marriage or at least my belief that she loved me. I'm not sure I'd abandon my marriage anyway because of what I think about marriage. I didn't abandon my hope for the relationship and even my belief that she loved me because given our history together, it would require far more than 51% for it to be rational for me to change. So the first mistake I think we make in apologetics in this culture, out and in philosophy, by the way, out of this kind of predisposition is to believe that we should always go with the preponderance of the current evidence. Instead, let me suggest to you a good epistemological principle. You should conserve a worldview that has worked for you as long as you possibly can. And that the more attractive an idea is, the more you should want it to be true and try to believe and defend it. You get no points if naturalism is true for believing the universe is meaningless and hopeless anyway. Right? Do you get points? No, there's no one keeping score. Now, if that's an unpleasant idea, that the universe is meaningless, why would you embrace it if you didn't have to, if you could still remain rational and believe that the universe had meaning? So long as I can rationally explain Hope's behavior and believe she loves me, and I didn't mean irrationally, I said rationally, why shouldn't I do so? It conserves wonderful things from my past. It makes sense out of my life story, and fundamentally what? It's more pleasant to believe it. Now, let me see if I can give you another cultural example of how this goes bad. If I tell you we're going to the movies, Kurt Wise never goes to the movies, I discovered, but I have to teach film every Thursday night. And so I said, we're going to a film and we're going to see a comedy. Do you think deep intellectual activity is about to happen? Seriously, your first thought, hey, we're going to go see a comedy. Do you think, woo, better read up. Better go to bed the night before so I'm ready for this. No. Now, forget all that. If I tell you we're going to go see a serious, artistically excellent movie, how many of you think it's likely we're going to see a comedy? No, you know, when I was in grad school, if a friend came to me and said, hey, we're going to go see an artistically excellent film, I knew that A, I was going to hate it, B, it would be very depressing, and C, there would be shots of a ball falling downstairs. And I would say, why is there a 10-minute shot of a ball falling down the stairs? And my film friend would just roll his eyes and pat me on the head and send me back to whatever coma I had gone into. No, actually, my favorite filmmaker is Andrei Tarkovsky. My favorite film, Andrei Rublev, though Sacrifice is right up there. So I get serious, artistically excellent films. I just want you to notice that you don't assume you're going to see a comedy or even an accessible film. Serious means sad, right? Happy means dumb. And the happier the film, the dumber we assume it is. I think one thing that's happened to sort of G films, family films, is that most of the people making them think they're stupid. So they are, because they don't believe in the view of reality portrayed. I live out in Hollywood, near Hollywood, and know lots of people who work in the film industry. And it's a mistake to think that most people hate evangelicals. The biggest attitude that you run into is that you're too happy. They're disturbed by your cheerfulness. And if they came here and looked at you, you look too young to be your age. What's wrong with you? Don't you understand the pain of the world? Secretly, we know that you're killing puppies for fun. Because We hope so. Because otherwise, you're so cheerful, there's something disturbing about you. Now, how many of you know that's about right? I'm trying to get you to say, yeah, that's about right. This is an intuition a lot of people have. Now, what I want to point out is that in the history of literature or even theater, this is not an automatic. It's so automatic that when I tell my students this, they say, duh, serious is tragic, comedy is stupid, except for As You Like It, which is about as frothy and as funny a play as you can see by Shakespeare. Amazingly, people become confused in their identity. What's the key to watching Shakespeare? Assume people are confused about the identity of other people. It's his favorite trick. And then he'll do it like 5 times. And so it's just, it's like very frothy. He tells every kind of silly joke he can. And then right in the middle, structurally, somebody walks out and says, all the world's a stage. He expected, in the middle of this, ha, 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 people are funny. Look, it's a girl, but she's dressed as a boy, and people don't know it's a girl. Ha, ha, ha. Even though all the actors were boys, so, oh, forget that. Anyway, do you see, just suddenly it was serious, because he expected there to be no distinction between comedies, which, after all, aren't always even funny. They just end in weddings. And tragedies, no, don't make the joke you want to make, which always end in death. And Shakespeare would play with the two categories, but he expected you to be thinking how often? All the time. Because it's Christianity that could create a divine comedy that was both serious and had moments of lightness. Only Christians can take a tour through hell and tell a joke like Dante. Right? Because who's God? God's God. It's a good universe. In the end, everything works out to be just. And so there's a seriousness to our levity. And there is a comic attitude towards tragedy. Tragedy, which is fundamentally of diabolical and even human invention, is sort of funny, right? In a dark way. Because Satan is rebelling against the good, the true, and the beautiful, which leaves him with what? The ugly, the false, and the bad, the broken. Why would you do that? So you could be Lord of Hell? Does anyone see the comedy of this? Notice moderns can't. So when we read Paradise Lost, we kind of root for the devil. Wow, look, what a tragic figure. Well, sort of. If you leave here today, go home and see a screwdriver and think, I should stick that in my eye. And do it, it's tragic in a way, but sort of not, because it's stupid to do that. Don't stick screwdrivers where? In your eye. See, nowadays we're soon going to have a whole internet support group for people who like to stick screwdrivers in their eye. Technology will work hard to make it possible for you to safely stick screwdrivers in your eye. And soon, we'll have a civil right for screwdriving in your eye sticking. You know, it's a weird culture we live in. And I think it's partly because what I want you to see is this assumption. Comedy is dumb. Tragedy is sad. I'll give you one final example from college. Pause and take questions if there are any, because I just want to have persuaded you that this is true. I'm walking across Biola's campus, smiling. People will say, huh. I walk across sad. People will pray for me. If I give a chapel message, I struggle with biological depression. It's depression caused by biology. And if I share that and talk about what the Lord Jesus has done in my life to help me, I uniformly have people walk up to me and say, you know, John Mark, we want to thank you. That was so real. Now, sometimes I'm tempted, therefore, to make things up. I had an awesome father. This is very depressing. Like, I can't blame any of my problems on my parents. So I'm tempted to just get up in chapel and say, ah, my father, he was bad. Let me share from my pain. And it's a total lie. And people would come up to me and say, thank you, Brother Reynolds, for sharing. That was so real. Even though it was a lie. Now, and the awful thing is, my parents were great. And my wife is wonderful. And I'm the happiest married guy I know. And if I stand up in chapel and say that, I say, man, I am happy. People will get mad at me. I'm telling you, at Biola, right? Bible Institute of Los Angeles, they'll think, what is he hiding? I didn't need to hear that. I'll say, look, Jesus, we are seventh year of our marriage. We're about to split up. They're sitting on their seat. That's good stuff. Keep going, brother. And now, 20-some years later, we are so happy. And they think, what's he hiding? And no one will thank me for telling them that happiness is possible, despite thorns in the flesh. Why? I think it is because all of us have adopted a fundamentally Homeric worldview that argues bad is real and good is luck, even in the church. Because I've never had anyone tell me in the church to get real when I was sad. They have only told me to get real when I was happy. My students are petrified that they'll go to church and be greeted with people with plastic smiles who say hello. I have never met anyone like that yet who is that unreal in terms of happiness. In fact, I believe the church has become infected with narcissistic, self-indulgent, overfed suburban kids who wouldn't know a real problem or tragedy if it hit them on the head with a hammer, but sit and write self-indulgent, false emo poetry that begins something like this. The pain in my heart is like the raindrops on the window of my mind. And they need to be told, get real, come with me to rural West Virginia or to Compton and see real suffering, real problems in places like India. Their falseness is not their happiness, it's their sorrow. But I've never heard get real applied to a sad person. We assume that sorrow is authentic, even though we live in a culture where sarcasm, cynicism, and sorrow is the only form of comedy that intellectual people are allowed to have. Now, I grew up on Monty Python. But a little bit of deflating goes a long ways. I recently turned on television and I saw some Colbert or Stewart wannabe making fun of people. What's next? Some wannabe Stephen Colbert making fun of people, making fun of people? We'll end up with an infinite regress of Stephen Colbert's. What will that look like 20 steps out? In the end, we need culture creators who create something real for the pythons to deflate. It takes the gospel to create a bad film like The Life of Brian. It takes the Arthur legend to make Search for the Holy Grail. And it takes a meaningful life to make the meaning of life. But if we live in a culture where what's real is ultimately the tragic, we're going to end up with a Homeric culture. Now, how does this apply to epistemology? Because being educated this way, I believe, leaves us with the overwhelming default instinct that the truth is going to be bad or disappointing. And I believe that much of our epistemology is not shaped by big idea people. Forget postmodernity for a minute. I'm not sure I've ever met a postmodern person. When I meet kids on the street of LA or talk to them in a film line, they don't know a thing about Foucault or Derrida. What we call postmodernity looks to me like the old hedonism for stupid people. Because when I talk to them, they are simply badly educated and have learned trick words to explain their amoral hedonistic behavior. But they still believe in absolutes if you push them. And I'm talking about college graduates. Let's remember that in the 1950s, if you wanted to party and drink too much, you learned about Skinner boxes and talked about materialism. And an entire generation of apologists wasted a whole bunch of time thinking that Skinner was the enemy, when in reality, a lightly educated group of partygoers had simply adopted Skinnerism as an excuse for their immoral behavior. In the same way, what's called postmodernism is at best a cultural veneer, but it isn't even much of a cultural veneer. The top films of the last 4 or 5 years have more to do with a 1960s comic book writer, Stan Lee, than Foucault and Derrida. Stan Lee is more influential, and Stan Lee tells traditionally Christian stories. So what's the problem? The problem is, I think, on one level, that the movies have taught us this. If it's Superman or Spider-Man, it's unreal. The Watchmen are more serious and real. And this will create an epistemological disposition for bad news. Most kids wish the Bible were inerrant. But I'll tell you, enough times watching commercials telling them that things are new and improved, and they aren't, will eventually lead to the disposition that, when in doubt, assume they're ripping you off. Assume that the news is bad. If two people come to you and say, what you want to be true can be believed, and what you don't want to be true cannot be believed, go with the cannot, because the cannot probably isn't gypping you. Not selling you anything. A bill of goods. Now, this is my cultural apologist, tip of the hat to a much greater man than I, Francis Schaeffer, take on why we demand more and more evidence for the existence of God and for goodness in the moral universe, when in fact we're less and less educationally capable of understanding the answers to the questions if we read them. Most people I deal with on the street, in other words, haven't passed the sophistication of C.S. Lewis's problem of pain. But they're perfectly willing to pose the question. And no matter what I say to them, even if the answer to their question is fairly complete, their disposition is to think I'm full of it, because reality must be bad. The Homeric worldview has triumphed. And the answer to why this is I believe the repetitive lies that people are told through free market advertising. It's not the entire answer, but it's a big reason for it. If you're told you can be a fairy tale princess again and again and again, and you discover you cannot, I think it sets up a disposition. If you're told money or things will make you happy again and again and again, even inside the church, and they do not, then it sets up a disposition. We are lied to again and again and again from the time we're small children by the optimists, quote-unquote optimists, and so we become epistemological skeptics. I'll deal with skepticism, which I like a lot, actual skepticism, in a second. But I want you to see the cultural problem we face. People assume if you give them good news that the burden of proof is on you. When I think in a healthy human, you ought to embrace good news if you can at all. If I thought there was any chance at all, realistically, that I would win the lottery, I'd give them a dollar. Why don't I? Well, there's some moral issues with gambling. but also I don't think there's a realistic chance I'll win. It isn't that I'm a pessimist. Okay, a couple of questions if you have any. Because this is what I want to persuade you, that the culture we're in is the problem. And that it has very little to do with philosophy, apologetics, theology, postmodernity. It's a kind of giant prejudice in favor of bad news. Or gypping us. Yes, sir.
So if that's the case, then when we, like you said in your last sermon, or continually educate ourselves on these issues, how would we go about presenting the argument to them if they're not intellectually smart or seeing?
First of all, we have to change our own disposition. When I started grad school, I struggled with this problem, and I went into the library of the University of Rochester, and I assumed that there was this secret atheist book of doom that I would run into in the library, and it would shatter my faith, and I would become angst-ridden and start wearing black and sitting in cafes with a beret. But what I discovered was that instead, if I approached every book with this attitude, look, something written by a soul created in the image of God, however fallen, where's God here? It's easy to see the devil. Go to Dachau with me. I take my students there. You want to see the devil? You don't have to hunt for him. You don't have to start with the origin. Go to Dachau. The devil, our culture has made easy to see. But there is nothing to be afraid of if you love Jesus. And so first, we have to change even our style, where we begin with a book or a movie saying what's wrong with it. Now, I realize people need to be told this who have missed it. But we have to account for why they like it. And if I'm right, they like it because of what's good about it. Why is sin fun? To the extent that it's good, it's fun. Fun is what's good about it. What's bad about sin? It isn't fun for long. And it ends up being deeply, totally destructive. God doesn't say things are wrong because he's an eternal killjoy. He says that a few things are wrong because they're the kind of mistakes we might make in a universe full of joy, because they appear to be joyful and the devil makes them appear that way when they're deeply destructive to joy. Yet sometimes when we look at a bad film, are there bad films? Yes, there are films I won't go see even to review or teach because I can't handle them. The bad in them is so overwhelming. I have to admit, I haven't seen Watchmen yet. I won't go to see it. It's just too much for me to handle, even though a giant chunk of my students have seen it and want to talk about it. I just won't do it. I've been blogging about it, trying to help my students understand why I should bother, other than just helping them. So it's not that I'll just see anything. But even there, when I talk to my students, I begin with, okay, what did you like about it? And I draw out of them the good, true, and beautiful lessons that they've seen. And then I say, but doesn't this occur in the middle of this? And try to help them understand what's destructive. I try to redeem what can be redeemed in their experience. Because I'm not afraid of that film. Which, by the way, isn't going to make money anyway. That's the way I approach Plato. Unafraid. Which is better, the Republic or the Gospel of John? The Gospel of John. Which is truer? The Gospel of John. Knowing this makes me unafraid to take spoils from Egypt. I sack the book. But I don't sack it for the bad so that I can beat Plato over the head with it. He's faced the judge, or will. All I have for Plato is pity and admiration. He's dead. He can't harm me. Yeah.
How do we understand this, like, in light of total depravity? Where it seems like the default position would be the negative, the bad, especially in our...
Yeah, I don't see that in Calvin. Do you? I see a classically educated person who is joyfully describing the world systematically and defending his view to a king in institutes, very optimistic that the truth will prevail. I don't see him having a default position to list what's wrong with the very classical training he's utilizing until he gets to the point where it is wrong and people might mistake his otherwise careful classical exposition of theology as being a kind of Platonism in a bad way or Aristotelianism in a bad way. And then he lets them have it. And he lets natural reason have it. So I'm not a Calvinist, I say hastily, but people on my faculty are, like Alan Yeh. And when we have discussions about this, we don't have to, on this issue, adopt a different posture. So I'm much more Wesleyan in my doctrine. I know, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I was raised this way. But I don't think that what I'm saying, and if Alan were here, it's a good Oxford PhD in theology, that I've had this discussion with him. I don't think anything turns on any theological differences we would have about depravity. Total depravity is the part of Calvinism I think everyone should embrace. And most people do. Who are traditional Christians in one form or another. Okay, any other questions about this? What I want to persuade you is what? Our culture has what default position? The burden of proof is on the believer. And the believer, what kind of believer? The believer in good news. So let me read you a quote from the internet from an atheist. There have been many arguments for the non-existence of God. These have been taken by some theists as proof that God indeed exists and makes atheists worried because otherwise why would they bother? In fact, the arguments for non-existence were the response to arguments for the existence of God. It's difficult not to reply when people tell you condescendingly or hatefully that you are blind to a superior reality, that you are in denial. I don't think I'm blind. Here's the key line. I'm not denying God. I just don't see any evidence for his existence. And so don't feel obliged to believe in him, least of all in his supposedly appointed human messengers on earth. The person goes on to say that the burden of proof is on whom? The believer, because they make the positive assertion. But using C.S. Lewis's argument, not any form of trilemma, Lewis was more sophisticated than that he puts in the mouth of Professor Kirk, we have to ask why the believer should be convinced by the failure of belief in the atheist. That is, if I claim to see an elephant in the room, and you claim not to see an elephant in the room, why is your failure to see an elephant in the room evidence for the absence of an elephant when I have the positive experience of seeing an elephant? Why do I have to go on and give you further arguments for my experience? Particularly if my experience of God turns out to be consistent with my continued life in this world. And yet, I believe that in apologetics, we have accepted the predisposition that theism is a kind of superfluity, a kind of additional option, an expansion of knowledge. It is, in the words of another internet atheist, abracadabra, hocus pocus, illogical. Instead of intelligently looking for answers to these psychological needs, people grab onto the easy answer from the religious silver platter. So what are the assumptions of most atheists that I meet? First, that reason is primarily about skepticism. Second, that history shows that strong religion hurts science. I hope I've already addressed that in my first talk. Third, that extraordinary claims, I want you to listen to this, extraordinary claims demand what? Extraordinary evidence. And fourth, that religious faith is not based on or cannot be based on evidence. But if it is based on evidence, it's based on insufficient evidence. Now, those are all the assumptions I ever run into. I am not claiming there aren't others. Those are just the ones I've run into. I'm not a sociologist. I haven't done a study. But in 25 years of doing everything from street evangelism to speaking at Evergreen College, the most liberal college in the United States, 2 weeks ago, those are the assumptions I run into. What are the responses that I give? First of all, reason is not skepticism. This is the bad news approach to knowledge. Skepticism is, in fact, a tool in a rational man's arsenal. If you are not skeptical, come and buy a used car for me. Skepticism is a good tool. When should you be skeptical? As far as I'm concerned, all the time. You should be, in one sense, skeptical all the time. You should be like a Berean, skeptical about everything I say. I wonder if that's biblical. Let's check it with the Word of God. Is that really the way I want to look at the world? So there's a constant sort of skeptical check going on in your mind. The question is, how powerful should skepticism be? Is it the only tool in your epistemological toolkit? I want you to notice it cannot be the primary tool in a person's toolkit, because if you're skeptical only and about everything, it is ultimately a self-defeating process. Now, I'm not saying anything new. I'm not saying anything you don't know. I just want to point out to you that the bleak or skeptical worldview cannot be foundational because you can't build a worldview on it. If it is the only tool that's useful, that's such bad news, we should try anything before we get to that. Now, I studied a place with, really, I say this seriously, world-class epistemologists. And ultimate skepticism is absolutely non-falsifiable. If you want to believe that you are a vat on the planet Mars, having an evil scientist simulate and stimulate this experience, then first of all, you believe in a very perverse evil scientist to put you in this room. And second, I can say nothing that would convince you otherwise. Yes? Every year, teach epistemology, some kid with this world-class epistemologist would raise his hand and say, "Professor so-and-so, why aren't we in the Matrix?" And he'd say, "Why the blank would I want to believe that?" And move on. Which seems to me a perfectly adequate answer, or there is no answer, to skepticism as the only tool in your kit. But notice, if that's true, that opens the door to belief because you prefer it to be true, if you can make it work at all. You don't have to look at the world as utterly perverse, because if you look at it as utterly perverse, it's impossible to look at the world. You end up seeing through everything, and so seeing nothing, famously. Now, why does this count so much? Because our fundamental negative disposition causes us to so misunderstand the world that we could take the film The Matrix seriously. But let me tell you this. If they walk up to you and hand you a pill, and you take it, and you wake up in a gross world where you're no longer in this beautiful seminary living in Kentucky, you married? Well, that's bad about your life. But you're single in the other world too. If you wake up in the other world, you're controlled by robots, still single, And you have to wear a black leather jacket all the time and look like a 90s reject. You should assume that you're on a drug trip, not that you're seeing reality. I have never, ever gone to see The Matrix with a student, back in the day when students still watched it, and had them ask the most fundamental question. If someone hands you a pill and you wake up and it stinks, why aren't you on a bad trip? How did they get away with this film? Once you attack reality right down to its core, that it could be an illusion, why not just pick the happy one? Back to Southern. Give me the other pill. I'm going back. Why isn't that sensible? How will you ever know which is true, folks? If the entire premise of The Matrix is true, here's what you know. You only saw the icky world when you took a drug. You were seeing the cheerful world when? When, as far as you knew, you were drug-free. I vote for cheer. But notice, even our Christian young people were able to go to the film, Your Generation, many of you sitting in the room, and not think of the fundamental cheat in the film because of what? Skepticism has taught us to see through everything except for skepticism. It's the one belief we have. But it's no good. You can't do it. If the Matrix world is real, you shouldn't believe in it. Why? It's so yucky. And it requires you to do awful things. Now, if you take the pill and you wake up and you're married and Billy Graham, only healthy and well and young, and people like you, and there are bluebirds singing outside your window, and you actually have money and a PhD, if the world is a golden place and Al Mohler is your best friend, he asks you to sign your books, stay there if you can. Right? I never understood people going to Narnia and saying, how do I get home? What? Stay if you can. Right? If you open the closet door in your dorm and you're in Narnia, don't come back. We don't need you. It's okay. Right? God doesn't need you to evangelize the world. Just stay, eat sardines with Tumnus, and have a good time. Right? It's okay. Now, why do we not do that? Why does Dorothy want to go back to Kansas? Because we assume in our culture it's better to suffer. But it isn't better to suffer. In the end, that's why you're going to heaven and no more suffering. I think some of you will get to heaven and be disappointed and want to go to hell because it's so much worse. No. No. So, skepticism is the only tool, just doesn't work. Yes? Questions about this? Just shout them out if you have them. This is so obvious in one way. I'm sorry I have to say it. Yes, sir.
I was sort of interested about the Matrix. There's, thinking back on a lot of what you said, is the bad guy is the one that wants to back to the good world.
Yeah, that's exactly right. The bad guy is the guy that assumes there's a good God and that we live in the best of all possible worlds. Given human sin, God makes the world as good as it can be. It's the best of all possible worlds, right? I know this can be parodied. That's what you have to believe. How powerful is God? All powerful. How good is He? If He who can does not, it must be better so. So if you wake up, brother, fundamentally in a world that's better, which is the real world? The better world. Or your theology is false. Now, if you wake up in a world that seems to be better, but it isn't real when you test it, come back to reality. Reality is better because it's got the whole reality thing going for it. I don't know how to explain why reality is better other than to say, reality, it's better. Here's the problem with skepticism in science. Science fundamentally cannot be only skeptical. It has to be based on theory and belief. It has to be based on assumptions to make progress. And in fact, progress in science was made by embracing false ideas. When I was a kid, I was taught in school, look how wonderful it was that we moved from false ideas to the truth. That's what science does. No, often science makes progress by moving from one false idea to another false idea. Nobody explained to me in school that when we moved from geocentrism to heliocentrism, we rejected one false idea for an equally false idea. Why did we do it? Because it was mathematically more elegant. It made sense. Which was true? Geocentrism or heliocentrism, given modern knowledge? Neither. So science, in fact, does not advance by moving from truth to truth. It often advances by picking better false ideas over earlier false ideas. What does this mean? Creationists are mistaken that the fact that they're right makes their views preferable by itself. They need to come up with a better account Because in some ways, it can be more scientifically fruitful to believe a false idea that is usefully worked out than to believe the truth when it's just a bare statement. If that doesn't get me in trouble, nothing will. Kurt, are you ready to rise up and strike me dead? You can if you want. You know more about this than I do, so I would defer to you, even though you're not a theologian. But this is very important. Being right isn't good enough if you're right badly. Right? Have you ever been in an argument in your wedding? It's mostly guys, so I'll just say this. And you were right wrong? You were so straight you leaned a little? I was playing Scrabble with my wife, and according to the rules, you can bluff. You can put down a word, play it, and ask your opponent to challenge you. So I put down the word Quetzal. My wife, Wheaton Honors grad, but a trumpet player, looked at it and said, Quetzal, I don't think that's a word. And I said, okay, challenge it. And she didn't. And I won. By exactly the number of points in the word Quetzal. Now, I made two errors. My wife said, come on, is Quetzal a word? My first error was to laugh. My second error was to admit that, in fact, I knew Quetzal was not a word and not just bluff for the rest of my life and claim, oh, gosh, I thought it was the name of an Aztec drink. I was about to serve you a Quetzal. No, instead I said, ha, 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 I got you there. And my dear Wheaton graduate, soft, sedate wife, picked up the Scrabble board and chucked it at my head. Now, I have never told this story to a group of women who did not sympathize with my wife and totally agree with her. In fact, we have asked hundreds of people whether I should have played the word Quetzal in the game. And overwhelmingly, men and a certain kind of woman says, go for it, the game's about winning. Overwhelmingly, people with children respond, those who have successfully gotten married, the game was about social interaction. And you broke the deep rule of the game, namely getting to sleep in your bedroom at the end. I have become persuaded by the second point of view over time. If you play Scrabble with your wife and she hates you at the end, what does it profit a man? Is this kind of biblical? No, seriously. It's kind of biblical. Now, what does this have to do with epistemology? Here's the point. What if you're right, but uselessly so? What if you go to a group of scientists and just say, you know, you're wrong? And here are some good philosophical arguments to show that you're wrong. And in fact, here are some holes in your wrong idea. In fact, giant holes you could drive giant trucks through. And here's our alternative. True ideas strung together in a scientifically useless way. Given what I told you earlier about skepticism and good ideas, they should stay Darwinist. Why? Because it works. And it's useful. And they like it. Whereas, even if you're right, you have nothing useful to say to them. This is a problem. And it's a problem not of the gospel or the Bible, but of our witness and application of the gospel, where when we're backed into a corner and losing an argument, we rightly state that skepticism isn't foundational. But when we negatively attack a belief, let's say Mormonism, we aren't content to give our opponent the same wiggle room. And people realize this. And we have anyway set ourselves up for a self-destructive apologetic situation on those cultural occasions when we seem to be losing the argument. And this is often the case because you know from church history as well as I do, the Church of Jesus Christ is always losing just to someone new. So we'd have to be switching all the time in some area or another doctrinally, but we do not because of the conservative principle of epistemology. In the same way, we're going to have to accept the fact that until schools like this and like Biola stand on the Word of God and create positive alternatives for people, a positive alternative, a worldview that is not merely parasitical, but right when we reclaim Christian culture, then people should embrace our view, but we won't have to worry about it. They will, because we'll subsume whatever works about Darwinism inside a more general scientific view. It is therefore insufficient to show that Darwinism has problems, just as it is insufficient to become an atheist to show that there is a problem with evil. And the problem of evil is, in my opinion, far more persuasive than any putative holes in a materialistic account of the world. Because at least in a materialistic account of the world, there's an obvious promissory note to find the answer. We found the answers in the past, we'll keep working on it and find another answer. Now, why aren't I a materialist then? Because philosophically, it's a hopeless view. It is an attempt, in my opinion, to get ideas from matter. And no matter how much time I give you, and how many red Legos, you can't build a blue castle. You cannot do an impossible thing given sufficient cleverness and enough time. You cannot get ideas, soul, mind, from matter, no matter how hard you try. Materialism and naturalism is fundamentally inadequate to explain the world as we know it. But on its own grounds, materialists and naturalists cling to it because it does certain work well that we have not done well. And until we do that work well, simply attacking them on their own grounds will not be useful. And in fact, we've discovered it isn't useful. Fundamentally, the useful thing is to attack them on our grounds, where we have done our homework in philosophy and theology. They have an inadequate theology and an inadequate philosophy, so Christian theology and philosophy continue to flourish, whereas Christian science is still in its most primitive stages. The problem with the third assumption, extraordinary claims, is that extraordinary claims do require extraordinary evidence, but as we've already seen, we don't know who gets to decide what is extraordinary. Is it extraordinary for there to be a global flood in the days of Noah if there's an omnipotent God? Well, it's extraordinary in the sense that it would be rare, but if there's a personal agent with a personal attitude, then the personal agent doing things isn't extraordinary, especially if he leaves us a record. So who determines what is extraordinary? How do you determine that a singularity, a single thing a person does, is extraordinary or not? You would have to know about the character of that individual. My suggestion is, therefore, to conclude, that we inside of seminary training need to cultivate a skepticism that is continuous but not dominant. We need to overthrow the cultural disposition that bad news is more likely to be true than good news and treat bad news and good news equally with a disposition towards the good. If they find a bone box and it looks like it's Jesus' brothers, you should want it to be real while being skeptical. Not assume it's a fraud while being open to maybe it's real. Right? If they find Noah's Ark somewhere in mountains in Turkey, trust but verify. Reagan was right about a lot of things. Extraordinary claims will always depend on the bottom line of what you consider fundamental in the universe. Here's what I would suggest to you, you know, is fundamental. And then I'm done. I know I exist, but I'm not sure about you. I think probably. you flew me out here. Somebody sent flowers to my wife. This is now my wife's favorite place for me to speak. All in, whoever did that, score. Once applied, somebody wanted me to take a job, not at Biola. Went there to visit. My wife was there. They left her sitting in an alcove the entire time. I was enamored with their vision of reality. I came out and said, oh, my lands, we have to do this. And she said, we will never go to a place that leaves me sitting in an alcove for 4 hours. And I said, ah, I get it. Now, what does this mean? I'm sure I exist, not so sure you exist, not so sure hope exists. But I'm so overwhelmed by the love of hope that I'm willing to take the risk with her, much less willing to take the risk with you. Just a little bit, and I doubt your existence. Why? Because given a choice, humankind will bet on love. Lead with love. Because all those people in California who want to be married but shouldn't be, at least know that it's love that moves the heavens and the furthest stars. At least they know that twisted and broken as it is, it's love that's worth defending and preserving and looking for. No person has ever started in sin. Any sin, even overeating, without a broken notion of love. And I'll tell you this, a materialist can reduce love, but he can't sustain romance. In the end, materialism can produce pornography, it cannot produce Shakespeare. In the end, materialism says that my love for hope is one selfish gene pursuing another selfish gene, but a person who believes that has never been on a moonlit night walking with my wife. And if you look up at the heavens and what you see is a reductionistic, hot, glowing ball of gas, then I think you've seen what it's made of, but you know nothing about what it is. Why? Because who would want that to be all there is? Who would want love to be reducible to a chemical phenomena? We have good, true beauty. They have peace, bread, and land. And I think it's time we forced the issue and said, you can have peace, but we're at war with injustice. You can have land, but things can't make you happy. And you can have bread, but you've just lost romance. It is a time, my friends, for chivalry. It is a time for poetry. It is a time for romance. And it is a time that we recognize that the Psalms are as real as romance. That saying things in a song can be as true as saying them in a proposition. That deep feeling you have as you stand by a grave is as real an experience as in a laboratory. But the feeling in the laboratory is no less real. It is time we unified the world like we did so long ago when Christianity was born and the Word became flesh and heaven and earth were reunited on a cross. And the union of God and man, the possibility of seeing the face of God, of seeing the love that moves the heavens and the furthest stars, was bought by the blood of Jesus, a blood that cannot be analyzed, but only accepted. Thank you. God bless you.